All right, go ahead.
Hello.
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 Testing 1, 2, 3.
Good.
It's Sway.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I've never pronounced
it. No. Nobody ever gets it right the first time.
So, do you have any questions before we begin?
I'm sure I'll have some later, but
all right,
go ahead.
Date.
Time of day.
It's November 9th, 10 a.m., 2016. So, what is your current job title?
My current job title, I'm president and co-founder of Robomoto, a video game development house in Chicago.
Right. So I know earlier you got into arcades. Do you still spend time in arcades?
Believe it or not, yeah. It's the arcades that I'm at nowadays mostly are these family fun center type places, especially because I have kids, and so you got the Dave and Buster type places. So I guess they're called arcades, but I've been hanging out more at some these barcades that have been popping up lately, so like a lot of places that are basically craft beer and old classic arcade machines. And then and then there's an arcade out in Brookfield called it's an arcade called the Galloping Ghost Arcade, and that I've been there a lot because I've been shooting my documentary there. And it's basically, from what I believe, it's the largest arcade in the world. I think they have something like over 400 arcade machines there, and it's like a museum, of classic arcade games. So if you ever get a chance, you could go check that out.
That sounds awesome. So when you were young, what attracted you to the arcade atmosphere?
Boy, the thing about arcades back then was, there were a couple of different reasons why I really liked arcades. One was that it was just it was almost like a safe haven for a kid to go to and then that parents never went to, So it's kind of like a playground in some ways, but it's almost like a video playground. So, I would go to an arcade, I would play a bunch of different games there, and I was left alone. I could socialize with my friends, and we'd play games together, and it just seemed almost like no adult area, which was really cool. I think the other reason why I really liked arcades is that the games were just really powerful compared to what you would have at home. So a lot of people they'll talk about games that they played on their Nintendo or on their Atari 2600, and I hated those machines because those games were usually ports of arcade games that were playing the arcade that were much better, on an arcade machine, because back then, video games were crafted to be in one cabinet with a very specific control to them, and so they were just super fun to play. They were very focused, and they were a lot more powerful in terms of the way how fast they were and how the graphics were.
Oh, I was wondering, because I did read about an article that you were kind of really snob about arcades.
Because back then, like I said, the machines were made to play one game, and so they were super optimized. So a game like Robotron that was done here in Chicago, it would have would see like hundreds of enemies on screen, and you would never be able to see something like that on a home system like an Atari 2600. But the thing is, you go in an arcade and play this thing, and it's just nuts, and it's fast and furious, and you end up in a pool of sweat when you're done playing it and stuff, and nothing could beat that. And so, I was a total arcade snob, and my brothers actually managed the gigantic arcade out in California. It was basically, it's like a Mark Twain boat that had three floors of arcade games in there, and so they managed it, and they were a lot older than me. And so when they would babysit me, they would give me a sack of tokens and just let me go nuts in the arcade for like 8 hours a day. So that kind of fed into my arcade snobbery. And so I never bought a home system until until the ColecoVision, because that was the closest thing to an arcade machine you can get at home. They had an incredible port of Donkey Kong and Zaxxon, and that sold me on that. But after that, I never bought another console again until the first Xbox. And that's only because my company was making an Xbox game.
Right. You mentioned hanging out with friends and socializing. Were there, like, any gaming communities, like, in the time?
You know, maybe there were, but not in my circle. And my circle is basically me and my friends who we used to go, we would go to playground together, go skateboarding together, or we'd go to an arcade together. So it wasn't like we only went to the arcade and just hung out there. It was just kind of part of the circuit of things that we did.
Okay.
And so it's you know, we would play, back then there weren't as many head-to-head games, you know, so you would play a game and then you would like switch off from one player to the next. So it was more, it's almost like a, I wouldn't even say it's a co-op type situation, but it was just like a turn-based thing. So it was really more of that. There wasn't any real organization back then.
Back then, we kind of went over some like violent games.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any games that stood out in serious violence to you back then?
What era are you going to talk about? Just overall, in general, or?
More when you were younger.
When I was younger. That's a good question. You know, it's ironic. Like, I never really thought about it, but I think the ones that had any violence, it was so abstract that you didn't really think of it as violence, you know? So, let's say in a game like Robotron, where you're just trying to destroy as many robots as possible, but if the robots get a hold of the family that you're trying to save, they either get killed or they get turned into mutants. That's about the level of violence you can get, you know, because the resolution was so low back then. It wasn't like things were like gritty, realistic, or anything like that. So you didn't really, if you think about the themes, yeah, it can be violent, but you just never thought about it that way. Your whole thing was, I want to get as high of a score as possible. It wasn't about the violence. So. I mean, obviously, that changed later on as games got more and more detailed and such. But yeah, I mean, especially in the 80s, it just really wasn't a part of the game design.
Did your parents ever think of video games being violent?
My parents? You know what? No, I don't think so. You know, it's like I said, like, because of the 80s, it really wasn't it really wasn't an issue, so they didn't think much about. Now, with that said, you know, my parents, you know, I think they might have been very different from other parents because they kind of let me pursue a lot of the things I loved as a kid without any judgment. And so I used to collect comic books. And comic books back then, you know, were, yeah, I mean, it's, and I am thinking the same way now, but comic books back then were, you know, there was some violent content in them. But my parents were just happy I was reading, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, or I'd go skateboarding and stuff, and, you know, the skateboarding community sometimes is not the most, you know, sane people around and stuff, but they were happy that I was outside playing. And so when I play video games, I think it's one of those things where if I did it to excess, you know, they might have said something, but I was kind of a latchkey kid, so as long as I got my homework done, my grades are fine, they, you know, and I got home safely, they didn't care what I did.
So we're gonna move into like the early career.
Sure.
Midway. You said you lived in California?
Yeah, so I grew up in California in a suburb called Arcadia, and right outside of Pasadena in LA County. So I grew up there all the way up until high school, and then my family moved to Michigan, and I ended up in Chicago.
Was there anything that brought you to Chicago?
Yeah, I wanted to, being a California kid, you know, I loved games, but back then, nobody thought of games as a career. It was just something that was magically made by elves and unicorns somewhere. You had no idea how games were made, seriously, you know. So I wanted to get into filmmaking just because I was coming from California, from Southern California. So I didn't want to move too far away from my family, and I saw that there were some schools here in Chicago that taught film, and so I ended up going to Columbia College, Chicago, to study filmmaking. And so I did that for 4 years, and what kind of got me into video games was the last year I was there, they started building up the computer graphics lab, and I was always fascinated by computer graphics, especially after watching Tron, the first Tron. You know, that was always in my head to see what that was about. And so I got into digitizing video for computer graphics and trying to see if there's anything I can do, you know, with the two different mediums.
Did you have any prior work experience with video or?
Yeah, I mean, it's the, I mean, like, you know, I did take a lot of film video courses. I did a lot of short films, did a lot of short films on both film and video, and so that kind of was a nice segue getting into computer graphics, and that little bit of experience towards the end of my academic career is what kind of led me into my first game job.
So when did you get your first job in the gaming industry?
So I had graduated from Columbia College. Oh my God, what year was that? I want to say 91. I mean, that's like a long freaking time ago now that I think about it. and my first job was actually at Northwestern University at this research institute doing UI work, primarily interface stuff. And a friend of mine had gotten a job at Midway Games working on this crazy shooting game called Revolution X that starred Aerosmith. And it was a crazy gun game. But he, back then, the first Mortal Kombat had just come out. They were starting on the second one, and Revolution X was also being done. And all three of those games, they were using digitizing techniques, which was basically putting an actor in front of the green screen, digitizing them into sprites, and putting them into the game. And he recommended that they interview me for a possible artist position there because I actually had experience with that process. Most of the artists up until that point were more illustrators than they were video people, and so they wanted to bring some more video people in. So I came in, I interviewed, I think, 7 to 9 times over the course of a year because they just did not know what to do with me because I was so different from everybody else that they hired because, again, they were all illustrators, and here I come. I'm not an illustrator. I know film and video, and they just weren't sure what to do. So then in the meantime, during that year, I ended up getting married. And when I came back from my honeymoon, literally the day I came back from my honeymoon, I get a phone call saying that they wanted to hire me. And so so right off the bat, my wife became what's in the industry called a video game developer's widow, which was basically I went right to work and she never saw me for many years.
During that time, how would you describe the personality of the coin-op industry?
The industry itself or the development part of it?
The industry,
okay. So the personality of the industry itself was very interesting. A lot of people don't realize that there's a whole network of how machines get to the arcade. It's not like the arcade operator or owner goes out and buys a machine and, you know, and is ready for business. It's like this whole network of distributors that you have to deal with. And so at that time, you know, if you went to an arcade, the arcade owner did not own any of the machines. They had to get it from a distributor, and the distributor buys it from the company such as Midway. And so, you know, it was kind of this weird, and this is my perspective, it was like this weird organization where it was, you know, it almost bordered on like mafia stuff, you know. It's like you just never know like where the money was going. And so So that was always on the business end of things. That was always a strange thing. On the arcade, as a player, as somebody who goes to an arcade or went to an arcades in the 90s, there was a big difference between the 80s and the 90s era. 80s era, everybody was playing arcade games, you know. So you had these broad hits such as Pac-Man. Everybody played Pac-Man, you know. Everybody played Ms. Pac-Man. Everyone played Galaga and things like that. Nobody was considered a hardcore gamer. Everybody played games. And so, like, when I would go to my brother's arcade, you know, that he managed, you saw young people, older people, you know, couples, and, you know, just this whole, you know, broad spectrum of people. By the time it got to the 90s, it started to become more about hardcore game players. And a little bit of that had to do with the fact that there were more options to play games at home. You know, so you had the Super Nintendo at the time and some other systems. And so some of the more casual players might have been playing games more at home, whereas more hardcore players went to the arcades. So arcades kind of got darker. Yeah, you go to an arcade and it wasn't like this brightly lit neon environment where everyone's having fun. You go to it and it's kind of seedy, you know, not smelling the best and stuff. It's dark and you go there. And people, people there were generally very respectful of each other. So it wasn't like it was like seedy and people were getting beat up or anything like that. When you went to an arcade, you know, people respected you. It's kind of like going to a skate park. Like, just the fact that you're there must mean that you there's some respect towards the games, respect towards the players there automatically. And so you go there, and it was just a different crowd, different personality. It was definitely darker, and it was definitely more, you know, hardcore, especially in the fighting game community. Like, they beat each other up digitally and stuff, but then at the end of it, you know, they're all cool with each other.
Now, about Midway, I was reading the Polygon article
mm-hmm.
about it, and you mentioned how it was like the Wild West.
Yeah. So development back then, you know, it was strange. Like, and I'm not, in all honesty, you know, I don't know if all game companies were like this or if it was just Midway. But yeah, it was definitely the Wild West in that, you know, we were all making these very successful games that were generating billions of dollars for people. And, you know, usually they were made by three or four people with almost no management. All that mattered was when the game was done, and we didn't go over budget, and that was pretty much it. There were, like, at that time, there were no game design docs. It just, stuff was being made up as you're going along. And that, you know, and that would never happen now. And even back at Midway in the 90s, once success really started hitting, you know, they started adding more and more management to things, and that kind of changed the personality for better or for worse with the way the games were made. But in the early days, it was a free for all. I mean, we literally had no producers, we had no management. You know, we'd be four people on the team, and we'd do a little bit of everything. There was no real official positions. It was a very flat, you know, type of management.
How many women worked with Midway at the time?
It was almost zero. I mean, it's interesting. It's one of those things where, you know, when I look back on it, it's like, it's shameful how bad it was. I would say that in the development area. Now, one of the unique things about Midway was that we had software, but we also had hardware. Because it's an arcade company, we manufactured, you know, the big cabinets and everything on, you know, on top of the software itself. So in the hardware area, again, not a lot of women, you know, but they definitely, you know, like, from what I remember, I maybe two or three, but that was still more than what was in the development area, at least in the early days. It started changing a little bit, but just, you know, it was still, you know, 95% men in there. And I think the only time you ran into any women on the team were, it was usually in the marketing department. And that was more, I would almost say that was, marketing and sales was almost more 60-40, where 60% women and 40% men. So if you look at the overall ecosystem, it improves a little bit. But if you're talking about the development, it's completely lopsided.
Yeah. What kind of difficulties did you face when working at Midway's? I remember you were, in the article, you were saying that it was kind of hard to, there were some giants in the industry. And that kind of like made you leave.
Well, it's one of the things where, you know, like, just for myself personally, I always want to keep doing new things and moving up in life. And I think, you know, anybody who has any entrepreneurial spirit, they want to do that. And so I saw Midway as a great entryway into game development, because it's, you know, as an old arcade rat, I was just like, whoa, I can't believe this is where these games are made. And so, you know, it was like, well, I'm going to go in here thinking I'm only going to do games for a couple of years, because I really want to do film. That was really what I went to school for. But once I got into it, you know, I really enjoyed doing it. And, you know, to be in the presence of people like Eugene Jarvis, Mark Tremell, I mean, there were literally titans of the industry working at this company, and they were some of my heroes when I was younger playing arcade games, when I found out who made these games. And to suddenly walk into a room and these people are there, and Mortal Kombat was just came out and was already a phenomenal hit, you know, it was amazing. But, you know, the flip side of it was that they, you know, these personalities ruled the company. It was, you know, the development teams, they, you know, like when I talk about no management, there's literally no management. So the development teams were the king of the hill, and the people that were leading these teams, such as Jarvis and Tramiel and everybody else, they were at the top. And so I just thought to myself that, you know, this is a great place to get some experience. And I rose through the ranks of, you know, ultimately becoming an art director at the company, you know, on a team there. But I knew that that would be it. There's no way you can go above that. There was definitely a ceiling there. And so because of that, you know, I thought to myself that, you know, the only way I can get beyond that is to break off, either go to a new company that doesn't have the ceiling or start my own company. And I didn't want to leave Chicago. And Chicago, it's kind of a good city for game development, but it's not anywhere near what's going on out west. And so I knew that if I wanted to kind of keep moving up, I'd have to figure out a way to start my own company. And so that's what we ended up doing.
Okay. What was your favorite project while working at Midway?
Gosh, that's a good question. I mean, I have favorite projects for different reasons. I would definitely say that one, if push came to shove, I think the first game I made there was my favorite, in that it was WrestleMania, the arcade game, and mainly because it was just such a goofy game. I'm not a gigantic wrestling fan and stuff, but this game, like, we just decided, you know what, even if you're not a fan of wrestling, you're going to come in and you're going to like it because it's just so goofy. We're just going to put everything, but the kitchen sink in there, just make it as crazy as possible. It almost had no wrestling in it, you know, which was not necessarily a helpful thing. But the fun part of it was that this was the era where the WWF, now it's called WWE, but back then it was the WWF, because back then they had a lot of just outlandish characters. And so it was just perfect for a video game because we didn't have to make up characters, there were already characters there. So we had like characters like Doink the Clown and Bam Bam Bigelow and Razor Ramon. They were already cartoons. And the cool thing about them was that we were able to bring them into the studio. When we started making the game, we thought we would have to make up these wrestlers by using body doubles, things like that. And the WWF actually allowed the wrestlers to show up at the studio and get digitized. And so we spent weeks with these wrestlers, and they were awesome, you know, and they were like super famous at the time, but, you know, these wrestlers come in, they're bigger than life, but they just kind of were like normal dudes, they're kind of hanging out and stuff. And one guy, Bret Hart, who was, you know, a huge wrestling superstar, he just wanted to hang out and learn everything there was about making video games. So he came in the studio, and after his shoot, he would ask, well, how do you digitize the sprites, how do you do the cleanup work, how does this work, you know? And because he privately, he loved doing illustration. He wanted to be an illustrator, so he was really into it. So that was a lot of fun, in that respect. But every game, I've worked on, there was something about it that I learned that made it super enjoyable. But yeah, the WrestleMania game was definitely, tons of fun.
You were Sub-Zero on.
I knew that was going to come up.
Did you like have to act out in the games?
No, it's like in Mortal Kombat 2, that's funny. If you play as Sub-Zero all the way to the end, there's like an ending story for each of the characters, and so Sub-Zero takes his mask off, and there's a giant image of my face on top of Sub-Zero's body, and it was funny because I think that was like within the first couple of weeks I started at Midway. And John Tobias, the co-creator of Mortal Kombat, who eventually became a business partner of mine, he just kind of came up to me and was like, hey, can we like take a picture of your face for the game? Well, yeah, sure. And yeah, I had just started, so I had no idea what the hell was going on. And so they took a picture of the thing, and then next thing I know, that's the ending, you know, to the game. And then in Mortal Kombat 4, that was the first Mortal Kombat game that was done in 3D, with 3D graphics. And so Dave Mikicich, who was one of the artist designers there, he asked to take a picture of my face for Liu Kang for that one. So that was more of a playable character, whereas in Mortal Kombat 2 was more of an ending type of graphic. The funny thing is that, you know, we used to do stuff like that all the time. We would put each other in the games and stuff, and, you know, in NBA Jam and things like that. And back then, it was like, it wasn't a big deal. We just did it to be goofy. And it's so weird because like 20 years later, I get people asking, it's like, I remember, you know, I didn't realize that was you. I remember when I was a kid playing this. And it would make me really happy, and it would depress me at the same time, because then I feel super old. I was like, oh my God, it's 20 years ago. So somebody who was a teenager back then is now in their 30s, you know? So.
That's funny. I was looking at the NBA Jam and how you were like a secret player.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you ever like get to meet like the NBA stars?
No, so that's the ironic thing is on NBA Jam, there are too many NBA, players in the game, so there's no way they can bring them in real life. So what they ended up doing, at least on the first jam, was it was so primitive back then. They would go and record NBA games on VHS and then digitize like all the rotation of the heads based on the actual gameplay footage and somehow map them into the game itself. So there was it was literally one body with hundreds of different heads just kind of attached to it.
Now, more about Mortal Kombat. It was one of the first violent games. A lot of people kind of like bashed it. Did you feel any public resistance against making these games?
I mean, the thing is that not, you know, personally, no. It's one of those things where when the arcade games were being made. Here's the interesting thing. So when the arcade games were made and released, nobody cared about the violence in Mortal Kombat. Okay, I mean, that's during the arcade. It wasn't until the games went to the home systems, and this kind of goes back to what I was talking about earlier about how parents had no idea what kids were playing in the arcades.
Yeah.
So when it was an arcade-only machine, no parents knew. Nobody cared, you know. It gets to home, and suddenly, the kids are playing in the living room, the parents walk by in the living room, they're like, what the hell is this? And that's where the real backlash happened. And so it didn't, you know, we heard about it later on once the home releases were out, but it didn't affect anything, you know, because for us, in our minds, it was goofy fun. You know, if you look at the fatalities, and that's what most people are reacting to, they were so cartoonishly over the top that there's no way anybody would take it seriously. Only an adult who doesn't play games would take that seriously. And adults in general, they don't like anything that kids like. You know, like if you go all the way back to the 50s when adults hated comic books and they wanted to censor comic books and stuff, it's the same thing. And so, you know, when kids were playing Mortal Kombat and they're doing the fatalities, the kids are not doing it in their minds. They're not thinking, oh, I'm killing you, I'm ripping your spine out. Their whole thing is, I'm gonna do this thing, the secret thing that's going to humiliate you because it's so damn funny. And that's really the extent of it. And over the years, I think people started realizing that, but at the time, it was so shocking that they didn't understand the context of what's going on. Later on, you know, I mean, they're still making Mortal Kombat, they're still doing the fatalities, and now with better technology, the fatalities are a little bit more gross than they were before. So, you know, in my opinion, a bit of the charm has worn off because part of the fun was that it was just so goofy looking because it's so low res that you kind of had a separation from reality, which made it fun. Once a lot of these video games got more, I won't say they got more violent, but it got more graphic or got more detailed, then, you know, then it's like, all right, now suddenly, you know, it's this weird uncanny valley that you have to deal with.
There was one game, the Mortal Kombat Special Forces, that
yeah.
Come out. Do you think it could have been a hit?
I think, so I had worked on the original version that never got released, and it was completely different from what got released. What happened was, we were about, I want to say a year and a half into production, and then that's when me and John Tobias and a couple of others left Midway. We kind of basically left the game there, but you know, they could have finished it. I would say that if they worked hard enough, they could have finished it as is, but at the same time, I think they saw that it was a ton of work, and it was almost better to just kind of redo it. History will prove out what was the better way of doing it. But it was overly ambitious, and so it's one of those things where, like, if it was given enough proper time, it might have been fine. Who knows?
Your company's studio, Gigante.
Gigante, yeah.
You made the game Taofeng.
Yep.
Fist of Lotus. So how you said, like, fatalities got more gross. Is that why you kept that out of that game?
Kind of. I mean, the thing is that, you know, we didn't... There was a real risk of people thinking that we're basically ripping off Mortal Kombat.
Okay.
You know? And so we were actually asked to put in fatalities, and we're just like, yeah, you know what? It's like, we don't want to deal with that. You know? Because it just... And we're, you know, we're still friends, you know, with the people on the Mortal Kombat team, and we just felt like, you know, if we did that, then it just gets kind of nasty, you know. And just like any other video game genre, there's plenty of room for more than one fighting game, and so that's our mindset was, let's just do another fighting game that complements all the other fighting games that are out there instead of trying to directly compete, you know, with Mortal Kombat.
Compared to Mortal Kombat, there were a lot more women in that game.
In Taofeng?
Yeah.
I suppose. I mean, it's like later iteration of Mortal Kombat had... Yeah, I guess you might be right. I think ratio-wise, I think it was pretty more even, yeah.
Was there any, like, particular reason for that, or was it just the way it happened?
No, I think it's just the way it happened. I mean, it's... we did find that players really enjoyed playing a more diverse set of characters. You know, like when you're playing a fighting game, it's not like, hey, I'm going to pick a woman character just because she's a woman. It's more like, oh, what are her abilities or what are her weapons and stuff. So the gender at that point doesn't even matter. You know, it'd be like, you know, I'm not playing Jax in Mortal Kombat because he's African American. I'm playing because he's got these big ass arms that are going to crush somebody. You know?
How challenging was it to leave Midway to start your own company?
It was, well, I mean, we were ready. Mentally, we were ready. But there were definitely some challenges. One is that at that time there was basically a non-compete clause that we all signed, so where we cannot work in video games for a year after we leave the company. There are some companies here in Chicago that still do that, which is like just asinine. But we signed it, and the thing is that we were basically told that it would never hold water in court, but we didn't even want to deal with going to court. And so basically we left Midway and it didn't work on any video game related stuff for a year, and we just took that year to just kind of brush up on technology, and we have prepared ourselves knowing that we weren't going to work for a year, and we ended up just doing a lot of freelance work and then just getting business meetings set up and everything, and then right when the 1 year hit, then we started production on Taofeng.
So what happened with Studio Gigante?
So we did Taofeng for Microsoft, and then we did WrestleMania for THQ, and then there was a big shift in consoles. So the Xbox 360 was about to come out. So the first Xbox was, you know, dying out. Xbox 360 was about to come up. The PS2 was dying out, and PS3 was about to come out. So any time that there's a shift in the industry to a new console, publishers stop making new games. If they do, they do it internally. We were an external studio. And so at that point, nobody's going to spend money making games with an external studio. They'd rather spend it with their own studios. So that was the first time we ran into that. And so suddenly we, you know, after working with THQ, we had no game projects. And nobody was hiring out for game projects because we're a work-for-hire studio. And so it just, you know, projects tripled up. And luckily, EA Chicago was hiring because they really needed to get Fight Night Round 3 done. And so our entire team went over to EA, basically doubled their studio, and got their game out on time.
How was working for EA?
EA Chicago was great. So, you know, I don't know how it is working for EA just in general, but EA Chicago felt like Studio Gigante and felt like Midway in that it was had a very independent spirit to it. You know, our general manager, Kuta Sonoda, did a great job of keeping us insulated from just headquarters, you know, the crazy politics that goes on at the main office and stuff. So we were very well protected to just be creative. Later on, that might have caused an issue because we got to the point where, you know, when things were going bad for EA or just the economy in general, you know, it's like we weren't privy to some information that might have, you know, helped things out.
What games did you work on at EA?
So when I was at EA, I did, the first game was Fight Night Round 3 for the Xbox 360. Which is still considered like one of the best games ever made. I mean, it's like it's a game that I'm super proud to be a part of. A lot of people use it as back then used it as a demo of how great the 360 is, because it was such a realistic game. So that came out, was a huge hit, and then half the team went on to do Def Jam Icon, and the other half of the team worked with me on this Marvel game. It was a Marvel superheroes fighting game, and it was like this big ambitious game where superheroes are fighting each other in cities, everything's destructible and things like that. And that was one of those projects where it was just too big for technology at that time, you know, to be able to handle.
So when you were working on at EA Chicago, mm-hmm. and making that new Marvel game, how did you leave from EA?
So it's kind of funny. This is one of those serendipity things. So when I was at EA Chicago, I was talking to, you know, some other companies. It wasn't that I didn't enjoy EA Chicago and stuff, but it was just one of those things where I was like to keep my options open because there was a lot going on in the games industry at the time. And I had met some people from Activision, and they were wanting to, you know, coming off of Fight Night, they were wanting to kind of talk to me about possibly forming a team here in Chicago to do some games for Activision. And there was no specifics or anything like that. The issue was that, I could leave EA Chicago, but I don't know if I can pull the whole team off with me. And so we were in talks for quite some time, just kind of informally. And then the financial crisis of 2007-2008 hit, and EA was closing up studios left and right. And EA Chicago was one of the most expensive studios per person in EA's portfolio. And so they looked at EA Chicago, and even though we had a massive hit with Fight Night, Def Jam Icon wasn't received very well. The Marvel game was looking to be unsustainable. And so for them, if you look at it, you know, just in terms of dollars and cents, it's like it just made no sense to keep EA Chicago open. And so they basically closed the studio, at which point then Activision contacted me and said, well, you know, all your problems putting a team together, you know, do you think you can put a team together now? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. So I got, you know, the team that I was working with, got them together, organized them, you know, to a point where we kind of packed ourselves up, met up with Activision, and they came and they basically said, you know, it's like, yeah, we want you to work on an Activision project. We have no idea what it is, but it's either going to be Guitar Hero, a Call of Duty, or a Tony Hawk game. You know, is that cool with you guys? And we're like, absolutely. Any of those three would be more than happy to do. And then it ended up being Tony Hawk, which for me personally is awesome because, you know, being a skateboarding kid growing up in California, it was like the dream project.
That Marvel game, did it actually come out then?
It never got released. You can actually find footage of it online. There's some people who ended up with, like, you know, an old dev kit and posted videos up, which freaked me out when I saw it.
Because I remember I downloaded some game from PlayStation 3 store, and it was like a DC Marvel fighting game?
Yeah, there have been other fighting games before, but yeah, this was never released.
Okay. So when you started working with Activision, that's when you made Robomodo?
Yeah, so we formed Robomodo based off, with the team that we had at EA Chicago and some people that I had worked with at Midway and Studio Gante. So it's almost like this weird, you know, Katamari thing where I just collected people as we went along.
With your new company, how important do you think it was to diversify your team?
It was pretty important to do. I mean, it was like, you know, I mean, I definitely could have done better with it. You know, one of the challenges was that because I was taking on the team that we had before, you know, it was only so diversified as we went along. As we grew the team out at Robomodo, it was just, you know, for myself personally, it was one of those things where I wanted to diversify only because I was so tired of seeing the same people all the time. And it helped a lot. And, you know, like our second game that we did, this game called Tony Hawk Shred, which was a vast improvement over our first game, I credit that game being much better a lot of it because we had such a diverse team. I mean, we brought in people that weren't necessarily video game developers. They weren't necessarily even gamers, but they came in with their own skills that they were able to apply to things that a strict, you know, game developer would not have thought about. And so, looking back on it, you know, it definitely wish we could have diversified more, but I was like pretty proud of the fact that we did push where we could.
Guitar Hero, was that were you guys like the first people to start making Guitar Hero?
No. So we, I mean, it, like we, like Activision does. You know, he had another company doing Guitar Hero. So I mean, we mainly just did the Tony Hawk game. So we didn't do the other stuff. We did work with the people who made the Guitar Hero guitars because to help us make the skateboarding board for the Tony Hawk games.
That's what I was just gonna ask about, like, because you know how you said arcade games, you know, had their own control
yeah.
for a specific game. That's kind of like how the guitar was, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then also, like I said, for our Tony Hawk, for our first two Tony Hawk games, we actually made a skateboard that kids could stand on to play the game, and that, you know, for me, that was a direct link to the arcade development, because it was like, yeah, and I thought it was really cool. It's like, wow, we're gonna make a controller that is fine tuned just for this game, which was awesome because it kind of brought back the whole, you know, arcade feel. So it kind of came full circle in that respect. And you know, our first iteration of it was okay. We definitely needed more time, but our second iteration, because we brought in some different people in to look at the hardware and iterate on the code more, like I really felt like it was the second game was where we nailed the feel of it.
Yeah, I mean, I just imagine, because like I used to play Tony Hawk all the time,
yeah.
and, like do combos for an
hour. Exactly.
I can't imagine like trying to pull it off on me like standing on
the
skateboard.
Oh yeah, and that's the thing is, you know, I think that was one of the misfires of those games was that you know, you're dealing with a franchise that people remember really well, and so we were making in our minds we were making a game for kids, you know, and so a kid could go out, get on the board and play endlessly because they have so much energy. And so it tested extremely well with kids. The problem was that when the game came out, the hardcore Tony Hawk fans, they were expecting a Tony Hawk game. So they would get the game, and it was an expensive game. And they'll play, and they're like, what the hell is this? You know, this is nothing like what we had before. And people were very vocal about it. And it's not anybody's fault or anything like that, but it was just one of those things where if the messaging was a little bit more specific to people to tell them this is a kid's game, you know, it would have been a lot more successful than it was. But yeah, anytime you see kids on it, it's that we nailed it in terms of how the kids played, because that's how we designed it and that's how we fine-tuned the controls. We didn't fine-tune the controls for, you know, somebody in their 20s to stand on the board and trying to get coordinated with it, because it was just impossible. If you didn't skateboard before, you wouldn't know, like you would have a really hard time with the controllers, whereas a kid would get on it with no fear and start playing it with no problems.
Okay. So how would you describe a typical day of work at your new company?
Oh man, boy. I mean, nowadays it's really just about, you know, managing the teams, just making sure that you know, everybody is working on the right thing, that is on the right track, and nothing's going off the rails, you know. I mean, I've been in game development a long time, and it took me a while to learn this, but it was one of those things where my value on a team is more about it's more about managing and making sure that people are not doing the same mistakes I did when I was younger. You know what I mean? Like, nobody wants me to sit there with them and nitpick on every little thing or work, you know, or work in the code or work in the graphics and things like that, because they're much more talented and younger people with much more energy and more up-to-date aesthetics than I do, and that's their value. My value is just making sure that, you know, ultimately the final package is what we say it's going to be. And so, you know, it's weird. Like, I almost have this developer's guilt because I was so into the development of games for so long that I feel guilty if I'm not like constantly busy. But the thing is that it's better for me to not be constantly busy and be available to people. So that way, if they feel like, hey, yeah, I'm fine tuning this, can you give it a try? My head is clear enough that I can go in and do it, and I'm not trying to juggle a million different things at the same time. So my day-to-day thing is like very different from one day to the next, but you know, my main task is to be a level-headed parent.
Like, compared to Midway and EA, how would you say your work day is like, you know, Robomoto?
Oh, hugely different. Like, I mean, you know, EA and Midway, man, I was like, you know, working constant, like I was living, you know, at the, like, much like everybody, not just me, but everybody, you know, we were living in development. So, you know, we would be there all day working on the games, hanging out, talking about games, after work, playing games, all at the office. And then I get home at like midnight, you know, like when I talk about my wife being a video game developer's widow, I mean, it was literally that. I mean, and then we would hit crunch where we wouldn't go home for days on end, you know, for months. And it's a terrible problem, but like, you know, it's weird. Especially at Midway, it was just one of those things where I was so into making these games, I mean, like, because I knew that this was like a very privileged position to be in, and I really enjoyed being there. So even when I was in crunch mode, you know, I just felt like this is like heaven. Like, yeah, absolutely, I'm going to do this for a long time. And it was fine when I was younger. As I got older, then I realized, yeah, this is kind of messed up. it's not sustainable. And I would say that when we're at Midway, it wasn't like a mandated thing. It wasn't like somebody was forcing me to stay there. So I wanted to stay there. I wanted to prove myself and do awesome work and things like that. And even at EA, you know, it was some of that too. I think the real issue came when, you know, at some companies when they start mandating the crunch, then it's like, all right, I didn't sign up for this. But to go back to your question, you know, it's vastly different. Like, you know, at Midway, I mean, at EA when we were working on Fight Night, that was some of the hardest crunch I'd ever done. And in many ways, I think that scarred me for later on. I mean, because after that, you know, it wasn't like I never had crunch, you know, since then stuff, but it scarred me so badly that, like, I consciously tried to make sure that we were not in crunch as much as possible with varying degrees of, you know, success on that.
So, like, Romomoto, are you kind of like the Trammell kind of person now?
I guess, yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, that's kind of weird to think about that.
I just thought about it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, yeah. And again, it's appropriate. There's nothing worse than for somebody like me to be in the thick of development, you know, when I could find somebody who is in the beginning of their careers or in the middle to early part of their careers who has way more enthusiasm to just dive in and really start crafting something. And, you know, maybe a lot of that has to do with the fact that I'm a parent now and I can see that. Like, you know, a good analogy is that I make a point of not doing my kids' homework. I, you know, it's like if my daughter needs help on something, I let her ask me for help. I'm not going to, like, look over her shoulder constantly and ask, hey, are you sure you're okay? And things like that, and, you know, just harassing her on that stuff. And so it's the same thing. It's my value is much better to kind of sit there and be there for people.
How does the life cycle of a game in a less established environment compare to its counterparts at Midway or EA?
Can we repeat that again?
How does the life cycle of a game in a less established environment compare to its...
You mean like the development life cycle?
I would say like the game life cycle.
I mean, in all honesty, it's not any different because the games that we make at the studio are for a publisher. So like Midway Games is a publisher. So personality wise, there's no different. Like when I was at EA, you know, EA was a publisher. So we were the developers, and then we send the game off to the publisher, and the publisher would, you know, go start selling it. So in many ways, it's not any different. And I've been fortunate in that I've been in situations where basically I've been on teams that have a lot of creative control. You know, so whether it's at Midway with the lack of management, EA where we're very protected by management, or Robomoto where it's our own company, we've never been in a situation where it's like, I shouldn't say never, but, you know, we try to avoid situations where everything is mandated to us. You know, like we get hired because we're trusted to take over a project, and as long as they see what we're doing and we course correct where necessary and stuff, we're never like hammered down on things.
You are making your own documentary about Insert Coin. What was your motivation behind that?
So, you know, I mean, when I was at Midway, when I started there again, like it was that thing where I was talking about where I knew I was working with titans of the industry. You know, there were a lot of people there that I looked up to, and you know, the first Mortal Kombat had just come out. NBA Jam was already making, like, was already a runaway hit. It was about to make $1 billion that year. And this is all, like, from the small group that was in the back of a pinball factory. And so when I got there, I thought to myself, this is such a unique situation that even back then, I thought to myself, man, I feel like, I'm in a part of something that's going to get really big. And so in my head, you know, I always thought to myself that, you know, I should remember as much of this as possible, just kind of keep a mental note of this. And so 20 years later, you know, I was talking to some people, and, you know, and you know, they talked fondly about the games that were made back then. And one specific thing that had popped up was, I was talking to somebody, I forget who it was, but it was a younger person, and they were talking about Mortal Kombat, and then they talked about NBA Jam, almost as a completely separate, you know, as a separate thing. And I told him, like, well, you know, you do, like, do you realize that those two games, like, two of the biggest franchises in video game history, they were both made in the same studio, you know, by the same group of people? And he looked at me like, what? I didn't know that. So, yeah, and it's here in Chicago. And they're like, wait, I didn't even know Mortal Kombat was made in Chicago. And so that, coupled with my own, like, sense of nostalgia, I thought to myself, you know what, there's, like, you know, there's a lot of stories to be told about how these games were made that nobody knows about. And so I just thought to myself, all right, you know, I'm going to write some notes down and think, you know, maybe there's something here. And I talked to some people, and I started getting this narrative going where, you know, there's a game called NARC that was made in the late 80s. And it turns out that that's the game that sparked the technology that all of the games from Midway Games in the 90s came off of. And so that ended up being the catalyst of me wanting to do this documentary. And so, you know, so I started shooting some interview footage just kind of informally with some people, thinking to myself, you know what, maybe I'll put a trailer together to see if there's any interest on it. And it was, and there was a Kickstarter documentary that went up a few years ago that that I saw, and it was one of the first Kickstarters I ever pledged on, and I threw in a ton of money because I really wanted to see this documentary. And I became very friendly with the filmmakers, and I told them about my thoughts on Midway Games, and they basically said that, you know, you should try to see if you can get this funded. And so I put together a Kickstarter campaign, thinking it wasn't going to get funded. I just wanted to see if there was any interest. Took a long time to make the trailer, put it out there, and it just blew up on me. And so it's like, all right, well, that's validation. You know, it's not just maybe. A lot of times I think to myself, maybe I'm the only person that thinks this stuff is interesting. You know, sometimes you end up in an echo chamber thinking something is important when it really isn't. But the Kickstarter really helped kind of, you know, validate my thoughts. And so from there, I was like, all right, you know what, this is kind of coming full circle for me, because I started off as a film student. I've always wanted to make a film, and here's my opportunity to do this. And, you know, the timing is great. There's a lot of nostalgia for these games. You know, every 20 years there's this nostalgia for things, and the 90s are the big thing right now. And so kind of all the planets align. I just thought, all right, now is the time to do it. And so I've been working on it, you know, ever since.
Why do you think there's so much nostalgia regarding this point now?
Well, for one thing, I think, boy, that's a, you know, I think there are a couple of different reasons. One is that, you know, people are nostalgic for things every 20, it's like 20-year life cycle, you know? So, you know, when like, let's say, what, 10 years ago, people were nostalgic for the 80s. Like, I was nostalgic for the 80s because that's when I was, you know, in high school and stuff. A lot of people now that are in their 30s are nostalgic for the 90s because that was when they were in high school, you know, and so there was it was a fun time for them to look back on. Now they're in their mid-30s, they're wanting, you know, maybe they're about to go in their midlife crisis or whatever, you know, so, but they want to, you know, people just naturally do that. I think the other thing is that video games, you know, especially with mobile, have just blown up lately, even more so than anybody ever predicted. And with mobile games, it's interesting that mobile games are very much like arcade games. It's all about very simple gameplay. You can play whenever you want. They're very short bursts of play. It's not like, you know, I'm not sitting in front of a console, in front of my TV, playing a 30-hour game. It's like, I feel like playing Candy Crush. I'm going to play real quickly in there. I'm going to play Crossy Roads. You know, Crossy Roads is basically this Frogger,
yeah.
You know? So suddenly you have this generation of people who are not hardcore gamers, but they're all playing games. You go on the L train, everybody's playing a game. They don't consider themselves hardcore gamers, but they are playing it. And then, so now you now it shoots back to the 80s again, where back in the 80s, everybody played games. Everybody played Ms. Pac-Man. Everyone played Galaga. So it's come back full circle in that. And so suddenly you're having people who just like, who would never play a PC game or play Call of Duty or anything like that, suddenly wanting to play this stuff again.
So with Insert Point, who were some of the developers you were able to like interview?
Oh, so I've been, so there are basically 4 to 5 key developers that are pivotal to that era. So you got, you know, Mark Turmel, Eugene Jarvis is the biggest one, George Petro, and a couple of others who are the main focus, because they're the ones that, who created these mega hits. And then there's a bunch of other developers around them that help support the games themselves. So interview-wise, I'm interviewing a ton of people. I think I have like 12 people already. But the main story is around these. You know, it's almost like the I don't know if you, there's an old, it's an old movie reference, but it's I call them the Star Chamber. It's like these 5 guys that basically made the games that were the mega hits that propelled the company forward. And so I've been talking to them. I've also been talking to people, who know about the 90s era and can speak to it, not as developers, but as people looking at it as a cultural thing. How it impacted pop culture, during that era itself. And so it's a mix of different people.
Is there anyone you were really excited about?
The main 5 people, definitely. I think one of the things that you'll hear often is how Eugene Jarvis kind of came in and out of Midway Games on a constant basis, but every time he was there, he left an impression. And, he basically left Midway halfway through the 90s era, but he left such an indelible mark that everybody after that was influenced by it. And you see in the narrative of the documentary how he was just pivotal to everything that came out of that studio, both good and bad.
Insert Point is still being in production, right?
It's still in production, yeah. So I shot a ton of footage for the trailer, and I probably would be much further along, except that I wanted to do follow-up interviews just to kind of get more in detail. And as that happened, things started to kind of snowball, because as stories came up, I was, oh shoot, I need to pursue this story and this one. And so I decided to start shooting more, and then I'm also shooting in 4K high definition, whereas I originally shot in 1080p. And so because of that, I'm reshooting a lot of stuff. But interview-wise, I'm almost done shooting all the interviews, and then I start getting into B-roll and editing.
What is your hope for an Insert Point?
Oh boy, that's a good question. The reason I say that is it can go in 2 different directions. One, it can be a very much what they call an inside baseball thing, where it's like it's so detailed that only people who are really, really geeky about the era would be into it. There's a very big temptation to do that. At the same time, I don't want it to be something that only a niche group are going to really jones over, it, because there are really interesting stories, and documentaries need to be interesting and detailed, but really more about interesting. And so that way, it can appeal to a broader audience, because I want more people to find out about this group and what they were able to pull off. And so you can go either way on it. But one of the things about documentaries is that you don't know what you have until you start editing. Like you go in with an idea of a story, but once you start interviewing people, you have to be open to let it evolve. And that's what happened with the shooting. It's like as it evolved, it's like, oh shoot, I need to chase different things. And so I have a general idea of how it's gonna go, but it's not until I get into editing that I start linking things together that I'm gonna see where the real flow is gonna be.
Is there anything particularly you want people to take away from it?
The main thing that I want people to understand is that, kind of like when I was saying that when I was a kid, I had no idea who made these games, and all the work involved with it. What I want to get across is that, games are made by real human beings that work very, very hard to get these games out there. And even whether the games are good or bad, they're, you know, I want to put a human face to it and show the price that's paid in to make these things. You know, it's kind of like, you know, people don't want to know how hot dogs are made. Well, here's how the hot dog is made, you know, both good and bad.
I guess for closing questions, what drives you to continue working in the gaming industry?
Man, you know, people who know me know this inside joke that I've been trying to not do games for about over 10 years now. Like, every time I make a game, I say it's the last game I'm going to make. Seriously. And what ends up happening is that, because games are just so hard to make, it gets super frustrating. And so by the time I'm done with the game, I say I'm never going to go back and make games again. But then it's that, you know, it's a curse of being a creative person. Creatives always want to do the next thing, so a new challenge will come up, and it's like suddenly it's like, all right, I'm back in. This is too tempting, you know. After EA closed, I really didn't want to make games, but then the Tony Hawk project came out, and it's like, oh god, I got to do that, you know. So it's always one thing after another, and it's just the need to create.
So over like the 20 years in the industry, what developments or gaming technology has impressed you the most?
I think, 3D graphics, definitely. You know, when I started in games, it was still 2D, you know, so I was still using sprites and things like that. Seeing 3D graphics evolve to a point to where it's at now is really impressive, especially when you start getting into VR development. You know, that's like the next big thing. And see, you know, the other thing that I've been really happy to see is that graphics, especially 3D graphics technology, has finally gotten to a point where it's not about ultra realism. You know, for a long time, the chase was always to make something as realistic as possible. That was the, you know, that was our goal with Final Round 3. But now the technology is so great that people are over the realistic stuff, and now it's more about the aesthetics. You know, now you have games that are not realistic but are just beautiful. You know, it's kind of like paintings. You know, like paintings used to be about photographic realism, but then it started getting into abstract and impressionism, and people wanted to really push the medium. And so that's where we're at now with 3D graphics, and that's really great to see that, because realism is great, but it's so damn boring. You know, but if somebody goes in and just really puts in this great aesthetic to a game that just makes you feel, it's more about feeling as opposed to seeing. That's fantastic.
So what do you think the next frontier will be for CoinOp or video games in general?
Oh, my God. I think, it's hard to say. I don't want to predict anything because I'm usually wrong, and then I'm going to look like an idiot because this thing's going to be around for a long time. I think in the near future, it's definitely going to be VR arcades. That's already getting huge in China. And I think, you know, you look at, you know, there's a new Star Wars arcade game out there, and it's like a big pod that you sit in, and you feel like you're inside of a Star Wars spaceship. It's not VR, but it's this giant screen that envelops you. I think that stuff is great because it's like a simulator. So, you know, arcade wise, these big machines are definitely becoming more and more the norm. You know, Eugene Jarvis has his own arcade company, and he makes these gigantic, you know, racing simulators that are amazing. So you couple that with VR technology that's starting to come in. I think that's where it's going to be. It's going to be these big virtual, almost like amusement park rides that you can play at an arcade as opposed to going to, you know, Disney World.
Going off from that, I remember reading about something, how when VR first kind of came out, they didn't really go into that because there was no money to be made off of it, so to speak. Like, it was hard to...
Talk about like back in the 90s?
Yeah.
I mean, the idea was there, the technology wasn't. It was just too premature, you know. It's kind of like the difference between the iPhone and the Apple Newton back in the day. Like, the Newton came out and it was like kind of cool for back then, but the technology wasn't there to make it really great, so nobody cared about it. Was like VR is the same thing. The first I remember in the 90s, I used to go to what used to be called North Pier here in Chicago, and they had a virtuality center, and we would do VR stuff in there, and it was like, it's kind of cool. But it's, you know, am I really going to pay $10 to do this?
Right.
Whereas now, like, the technology is so far more advanced and perfected that, I would pay $10 for that.
What are your current challenges have you seen the gaming industry face? What recurring challenges have you seen the gaming industry face?
I think it depends on, you're talking about games themselves or the development of games? Because I'm always looking at one or the other.
Games themselves.
I think the challenges faces is that it's still too much, and it's not the company's, it's not any studio's fault or publisher's fault, but it's, you know, games are the big games that are out there that make a ton of money, at least on the consoles, are the same games. It's just the genres are really boring. You got your shooters. There's I wouldn't say that there's great innovation out there. You're gonna find the innovative games with more of the indie developers, smaller developers, but then those things are so different that they don't necessarily get a mainstream audience. So it's kind of like the difference between, like, you know, a band that can sell out the United Center compared to an indie band that, you know, might sell out, you know, like a small club and things like that. There's not a huge amount of great innovation going off with games right now. That'll change eventually, but it's like Hollywood, you know, you're gonna have the big Transformers movies that are gonna make a ton of money, but the more interesting movies are the ones that are smaller.
Have you ever seen the industry kind of fail to take advantage of something properly?
The game industry historically when trying to get a more diverse audience has failed. You know, console and PC games from the major, you know, publishers, they're not interested in any market that are outside of just your quote-unquote core gaming audience, you know. So trying to bring in, you know, older people, younger people, women, even like, you know, I don't know, just trying to get a more of a niche market is always been a challenge for them. And I don't know if they're necessarily interested in doing that. And so, you know, one of the bigger issues is that it's kind of like this chicken and egg thing where, you know, on the development end of things, you don't see that much diversity on the development teams either. And so if you don't have the development teams being more diverse, then they're not going to make games that are more diverse in theme. And so, you know, where does it begin and where does it end? So I think that's always been a challenge. Now, with that said, mobile games, that's where you're seeing a lot more diversity in terms of the themes and in terms of, like, the audience outreach, because everybody has a cell phone. You know, everybody has a smartphone that they can play games on, and so it's in their best interest to make games that, you know, that are not necessarily for the hardcore video game players.
Have you seen a shift in gender balance of people working in the gaming industry over the years? Like you said, at Midway there was only...
Yeah, it's... I would definitely say it has improved. It's definitely not where it should be, but it's... And it's, I'm not going to compare it to Midway because Midway was so, you know, abysmal with it. It's not a good comparison. It's definitely better. I think the rise of schools that teach games, you know, that is going to help things a lot more. You can already see the shift happening because of that, because there are a lot more diverse people that are going to school to study games, and then by the time they graduate, they're the ones that are going to be making the next generation. And that's just starting, you know. So it might be a few years off that you're going to really start seeing that shift. But I've already seen a little bit of that going on. It just depends on if they decide to go work for a big company or they go, you know, completely independent.
Do you think it influenced, like, the type of games that came out?
I think so. I mean, again, it's like, it's this weird chicken and egg thing. You know, do they, you know, if the developers, you know, is the audience there to play these games that the developers, you know, are trying to make?
Do you think console games have managed to capture some of the appeal of arcade games?
No. I would say that consoles are almost the opposite. Well, I shouldn't say that. In general, like, if I just talk about it broadly, like, the big games that are coming from the publisher that get ton of marketing dollars being spent on them, no, it's like, because it's console games by nature are more long form.
Right.
So I guess the way to look at it is, it's the difference between watching a movie a movie, like a big Michael Bay movie, has to be just big in scope and everything. Compared to that, compared to like a TV show. A TV show, you know, if you look at like television right now, is awesome. There's some great variety of TV shows out there. They're much smaller in scope, and they can get away with that. It's the same thing. Console games always have to be big because you're paying $60 to play a game, and so you're gonna want. I want spectacle. I want shit blown up all over the place and things like that. You know, whereas a nice, you know, arcade game where it's like, all right, I get a lot of action, but it's, you're done. You know, at a specific point, or you end up, you know, throwing more quarters. That doesn't play as well on console. It plays much better on mobile.
Okay. Yeah, I was just thinking of like playing Fallout on arcade. It never worked.
It never worked. Yeah, it's a completely different format.
What do you think it will take to diversify the industry successfully?
I think, I mean, I think it comes down to getting, you know, more people, you know, more developers, basically, you know, from all different walks of life, you know, studying game design, you know, coming out of these schools and stuff, and getting jobs in the industry, that and working their way up the ranks. You know, it's like, you know, it's weird. It's like, you know, in general, you're gonna find, especially women, you're gonna find women mostly in the marketing and sales parts of these big companies, but very seldom in development. And there's probably a lot of different reasons for it. You know, somebody I can guess at, somebody, you know, I can't and stuff. But really, it's gonna come down to, you know, if you're talking about in terms of the development of games and making more diverse games, it's just gonna come down to, you know, making sure that it's not just the same people that are making the games. Whether they come out of school or they, you know, they learned it on their own, they need to get themselves onto these, you know, onto these teams and make games or make their own games and get them out there. Again, it's like, it's, you know, I speak to that in terms of the PC and console games. You know, mobile games is very different. Mobile games, it definitely has more diversity to it than the other formats.
Do you think there's still like any production as far as like arcade games to make like new and reinvented?
Kind of. I mean, it's, you know, there are definitely there's still arcade games being made. There are less of them, but they're bigger. You know, so like that Star Wars one I was talking about,
right.
Like Eugene Jarvis's company, they did the Jurassic Park game. That's like this big cabinet that you sit in. You know, so there's like these big things, but there are not that many arcade, you know, companies out there anymore.
Is there anything you'd like to tell us before we?
I don't know. No, I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting to see where games are nowadays. You know, I like the fact that games now, there are so many different ways of playing games. Back in the 80s, it was just arcade and then maybe your 2600 console. In the 90s, became the console era, including 2000. But now, suddenly, with the rise of, you know, tablets and phones and just, you know, all these different ways of playing games, it's like, you know, it's getting to the point where statistically there are more people, there's more diversity in people playing games than there ever has been. And so, you know, a lot of times when people say that, you know, only men play video games, well, no, not really. It's really only on the console end of things that you can maybe make that argument and stuff. But if you talk about the overall spectrum, the overall industry, it is way more diverse than that. It's just, you know, people somehow, for some reason, they discount, you know, mobile games, and they can't, because the mobile games actually make more money than all the, you know, than the other formats. And so it's kind of nice to see that the general audience that isn't considered core gamers are playing a ton of games out there, and I think that, yeah, I think that's pushing, you know, some of the diversity moving forward.
Are we good?
Hi, my name is Bates again.
Oh. Thank you for letting us interview you, Josh.
Sweet. Yeah. No. Thanks for having me. It's I love talking about this stuff.
I don't know how to like end.
That's fine. That worked. Is that good?